הקצה משודרת מול פני BPM, המכללה של תעשיית המוסיקה. אתם עכשיו.
על הקצה.
אתם עכשיו.
אתם עכשיו. על הקצה.
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 Welcome. I'm so glad you could come. This is going to be such an exciting day. I hope you enjoy it.
Isn't it about time for somebody's favorite radio program?
Radio, what the fuck?
Movies is magic.
Cinemascope, Cinemascope in Yair Rave.
Radio Rahim.
So, yeah, that's the world.
That's the radio. This is the radio.
אהלן, סינוסקופ רדיו קצה, אני יאיר רווה, תוכנית מספר 178, תוכנית מאוד מאוד מיוחדת היום. את סינסקופ ברדיו הקצה עושים עומר סנש, בר זוודה, לאה שפיגל, ספיר כהן, חורכה כהן, תודה למכללת BPM, תודה לאורי קדישי, תודה לניר נימור, תודה לקואמי, תודה לבן אש שמפיק את התוכנית היום 4 ביוני, לא, היום 5 ביוני, כף ב' בסיוון, ויש לנו היום אורחת מאוד מאוד מיוחדת בתוכנית, מפיקת הקולנוע האמריקאית העצמאית, עדיין אחרונת העצמאיות, קריסטין ושון, הפיקה את כל הסרטים של טוד היינס וסרטים של טוד סולונס, ובאמת מחלוצות וחלוצי הקולנוע העצמאי האמריקאי של תחילת שנות ה-90, והיא פה בארץ השבוע כאורחת פסטיבל הקולנוע הגאה, קיבלה שם פרס על מפעל חיים, הפיקה את סרט הפתיחה My Days of Mercy שביימה במאית הישראלית טלי שלום עזר. אז בסוף השבוע יצא סרט חדש של טוד היינס, Wonderstruck, שהיא חתומה על הפקתו, והקולנוע, פסטיבל הקולנוע הגאה שמתרחש השבוע, ושהיא הפיקה את סרט הפתיחה, ובערך משהו כמו כמעט 30 שנה של עבודה בתוך הקולנוע העצמאי הניו יורקי בוויליג', אז ננסה להקיף את כל הקריירה ואת הסרטים האחרונים, את הסרטים המוקדמים ואת ההישגים שלה, ובאמת אגדה בתחום הקולנוע העצמאי האמריקאי, והיא פה איתנו, ומפה אנחנו עוברים לעברית. Hi, Christine.
Hello.
You have to sit really close to the microphone so I can hear you as well. Thank you very much for coming to our studio and to Tel Aviv. How do you find Tel Aviv so far?
So far, so good.
You like it here. So I was saying in my introduction in Hebrew that you're a legend. I think that you're a legend. I've read so many things about you over the years since 1991 when you produced your first producing title for Poison, Todd Haynes' debut feature film, long-form feature film. And from then until now, I think... You know, I'm a film critic, and we use the auteur theory. We look for films that we know their directors. And more I've realized that when I see your name as a producer, I know that it's a film that I want to check out. I know that it will be something independent, something edgy, something different, something that would look for a new ways of looking at films, at life. And many of the films that you've produced are some of my favorite films, and I think many of the things that you produced were groundbreaking films, beginning with the very first one, with Poison. And now we have Todd Haynes' last film here in theaters in Israel, Wonderstruck. So let's start about with your relationship and your collaboration with Todd Haynes. How did that begin? How did you begin your collaboration?
We went to university together, but we weren't really friends when we were at school together. When we both came to New York in the mid-80s, we were, you know, it was a time in New York of there was a lot of crossover, a lot of excitement in art and fashion and music and film. It's also, I think, a lot of people don't quite realize there was the beginning of MTV. So music videos suddenly were something that had to be made and produced. There was, you know, a whole system on MTV that had to be fed. So it was kind of an exciting time. And Todd was working on a short film called Superstar, the Karen Carpenter story, which has since been banned, but pops up all the time.
Wait, was it banned by the Barbie people or the Karen Carpenter people?
No, the Carpenter people.
Okay.
But it pops up all the time on YouTube. It's just it pops up and it gets taken down. So I helped him finish that film. I didn't produce that film, although I get credited for it a lot. And when I saw that film, I think it really showed me, it really articulated for me the kinds of movies I wanted to be involved in. It was provocative, it was wholly original, but it was also utterly entertaining. So I suggested to Todd at that time that we work together on the next one, Poison. Mm-hmm. And that was that.
Before that, were you a film buff? Did you like movies? Did you see a lot of film? Did you know that you wanted a career in film, or were you just dragged there by accident?
No, I mean, it was a different time, obviously. I grew up in the 70s in New York City. I could walk to a movie theater. It's what we did for fun. We often went into a movie theater without knowing what movie was going to be playing, or we'd watch one film and then we just would go from one, you know, most cinemas were multiplexes, mm-hmm. So we would just move from one cinema to another cinema, and if we liked a movie a lot, we would just come back and see it again the following week, like The Poseidon Adventure, which I think I saw about 5 times. But also because it was New York City, we were exposed to foreign films, which, you know, back in those days, if you said you were going to go see an art film, what you meant was you were going to go see a film with subtitles. Okay. And in some ways, that's a whole other discussion, but in some ways, the so-called American independent film movement pushed aside foreign films in the U.S., because at that time, it was much more common, I think, for films in a different language to gain traction in a box office, for example. But so there were a lot of movies. It was also the 70s, I think, was a great era for Hollywood filmmaking. Mm-hmm. And we didn't make the distinction. We just went to see movies because they were interesting to us. So all of that, I think, just built a foundation of understanding film language and discourse. When I came to New York I grew up in New York. When I came back to New York in the 80s, as I said, it was a time where, you know, Jim Jarmusch was making his first movie, Spike Lee was making his first movie, Betty Gordon was making her first movie. So there was a lot of excitement about personal narrative and what it meant. And it was kind of seemed to be erupting out of this notion, which I had really grown up with, was that, you know, there was the only movies that were not traditional Hollywood narratives were films that were almost aggressively anti-narrative,
right.
Experimental movies.
Avant-garde films.
Avant-garde, right. Brackage, movies like right. that, which I, you know, were not for me. So when I saw people like Spike and Jim Jarmusch and Betty making movies that were very, very personal, It was kind of a revelation. Then one of the first movies I ever worked on was a film by Bill Sherwood called Parting Glances, right. which also happened to be Steve Buscemi's acting debut, or his debut in a film. I think by that time he'd been doing a lot of acting. And that movie, again, really showed me that you could make a film that had a polish, that felt familiar, used the same tropes as a Hollywood film, but was about something that no Hollywood film at that point was ever about, which was, you know, at that time about, you know, a bunch of people living in New York under the threat of HIV.
Right. So if I could try and summarize the American independent cinema of the late 80s and the beginning of the 90s, it's on the one hand using Hollywood styles and tropes, as you said, to deal about with topics that Hollywood wouldn't dare use, and on the other hand, using style and a new way of visual expression. And, Poison is a really good example for that. That Hollywood didn't use, and which is more European, I think, in a sense.
I suppose. I mean, I don't know. I sometimes get tired of this. You know, what's European? You know, if anything seems, you know, slightly off kilter, it's European. Yeah. I think it's more original than that. I think that there was that it was also bred out of, frankly, you know, limited access to equipment or visual effects, and figuring out ways to tell stories using the limited means at hand. I mean, Jarmusch famously shot Stranger Than Paradise with the short ends of a Wim Wenders film. So, you know, that's saying, all right, this is what I have, so what can I use, what can I do with it that makes narrative sense to the story I want to tell? That's innovation, you know, and that's very American.
Yeah, okay. At that time, you know, Poison was on the on one hand, but my favorite film from that era was another film that you produced called Swoon,
mm-hmm.
by Tom Kaelin. And with Swoon and Poison, all of a sudden everybody talked about the new queer cinema.
Right.
Was it a political thing for you? Was it an artistic thing for you? Were you looking for themes that were LGBTQ themes in films? Or were you looking for a new style of filmmaking and a new breed of filmmakers?
Well, there were several things going on at that time that I think it's important to understand. First and foremost, there was the AIDS crisis.
Right.
So there was certainly a feeling that, you know, amongst gay and lesbian people, that if you didn't tell your story wasn't going to get told. And that you were running out of time. There was a sense of urgency. It's very hard to describe that time in New York City if you didn't live through it, because it seems so surreal. But literally, you would see somebody on the street, and then a week later, they'd be gone.
Wow.
And sometimes it would be because they had died. Sometimes it would be because their family had come in. They'd gotten sick, and their family had come in and taken them away from their home and their friends. And you'd never even know when and if they'd died. So it was a crazy, crazy time. There was a particular Sundance Film Festival where I think it Swoon showed, but also a film by Greg Araki called The Living End, a film by Isaac Julian. Now I can't remember the name of it.
The Reflecting Skin, was it?
Which one did you say?
The Reflecting Skin?
Looking for Livingston, I think it was. Looking for Langston, sorry. Looking for Langston. But there was a handful of movies that all felt unified by Christopher Munch's film, also The Hours and the Times, a handful of movies that felt unified by a sort of common queer sensibility. However, I think that I think to call it a movement is a little bit misleading, because I think that you know, there was that sense of urgency, so that was happening, especially in movies like The Living End, which took the AIDS crisis on head-on. Paris is Burning is another example. Mm-hmm. But I think there was also a growing realization that you could actually make a film that had queer content, and if you made it for the right amount of money, it could appeal only to a queer audience, and it could still be profitable. And that was an incredibly empowering notion. You know, that was like, you know what, we can make movies just for ourselves. We don't have to worry about whether or not straight people like them or not. We can make them completely in an uncompromising way, but we can still make them at a profit. And that was extraordinary.
Yeah. And did those films feed each other? Was the success of Poison lent to making other films in those? When I say movement, you know, a movement, you say it's misleading because it's not an organized group, but maybe the success of one film made newcomer, new filmmakers think, okay, I can do it too, and the producer would say, okay, it's not as risky as making that first film. That would
I don't know. Make I mean, a movement. It all felt pretty. You know, it kind of felt like the Wild West. I mean, I think Go Fish wouldn't have come to Tom and I because Rose Troche and Gwen Turner sent us a few scenes that they had shot, and it wouldn't have come to us if we weren't already, you know, in the news with, you know, Poison and Swoon. Mm-hmm. So it certainly gave me opportunities I wouldn't have had otherwise. It was still, you know, everything was so different. I mean, movies could only be shot on film, and film was expensive. So that's why there were lots of stories about how did you get film? How did you, you know, how did you process it? There was that. And movies could only show in a theater because, you know, when we first started making Poison and Swoon, VHS was so new that most people couldn't afford video recorders. It was really something, you know, that only rich people had.
So let me tell you about here in Israel. Those films that you did in the early 90s, the only way to see them here in Israel was either at the Jerusalem Film Festival,
right,
once a year in July, or on VHS. We have a specialty VHS library or store,
right,
here in Tel Aviv. And most of the people, everyone who's told you that they've seen Poison, I was in the opening night ceremony, many people told you how Poison changed their lives.
Right.
Everybody saw it on VHS here in Tel Aviv. So that was some sort of an underground movement of VHS tapes. Original VHS tapes, not pirated ones, I think, that people saw, and or film clubs that,
right,
that were underground film clubs. People saw it. They were not shown in cinema here. I think that Go Fish may have been the first film,
mm-hmm,
from that group that was distributed here in Israel commercially. Let's talk a little bit about longevity, because Todd Haynes, You produce his first film, and almost 30 years later, he's still making films, some bigger, some smaller.
Right.
But someone like Tom Kalin, who did Swoon, didn't have as a prosperous career as a filmmaker,
well,
as a director.
Well, he had a different career. I mean, Tom and I produced a couple of movies together. We did Go Fish together, and then we did I Shot Andy Warhol together. Tom has gone, you know, he's... and then he did Savage Grace, which we produced, I think it's just had its 10th anniversary. He's made a lot of art videos. He's had, mm-hmm, his work is shown in major museums. You know, there's different ways to have a creative career,
right,
and I think it's a little reductionist to just say, yeah, you just got to make a movie, and then you make a bigger one, and then you make a bigger one, and then you make a bigger one.
Yeah.
It just doesn't work that way anymore, I don't think.
Okay, so the reason I'm asking is because, as I said, Swoon was for me the film that introduced me to the new queer cinema,
mm-hmm,
and made me. I'm a straight film critic, but I always look for something new, and anything that came out from your office from New York in the 90s from that group, Todd Haynes or Tom Kalling or Todd Solondz or any of those. That group was something that I knew that I wanted to see, and more. I lived in New York for a couple of years in the 90s. I knew that if I want to see something new, something edgy, something alternative, I have to go and see to watch films at the Outfest, the Gay and Lesbian Film Festival. That's the way. That's where I saw Go Fish and all the rest. So that was something that was so alternatively creative. I felt like this was like our time, our generation's 70s. You can do anything,
right?
And it would be profitable, and it would win awards. It wouldn't be marginalized as an underground film. It would become popular in an alternative context. when and how and why did it end ultimately?
Well, has it?
You tell me.
Well, I mean, you tell me. I don't think it's ended.
Would Todd Haynes make Poison these days? Or
but why would he? He's 30 years older. I mean, I find that argument so reductive. Like, would you do this movie today? Well, you know, Trump is president. you know, gay people can get married in the States, at least for now. I mean, it's just like the world is so different. I think there's plenty of young people making extraordinary work that, frankly, we're a little too old to know where to find it. And okay. to just say, oh, well, that was then and that was so great. It's like, come on, Grandpa. Like, you know, that's our filter. Mm-hmm. I know, for example, that, you know, my daughter, who's 18, that she, you know, she at a certain point, she discovered certain original voices, say, on YouTube or other platforms okay. that really spoke to her in ways that, you know, I would say, like, when I discovered punk rock when I was 16, I felt like this was mine, and this had nothing to do with the adults in my life. And it was a language that only a dog whistle, that only I could hear. And of course every generation has that.
Okay.
You know? So I think, look, I think it's great that I'm not trying to denigrate that body of work. I think it's extraordinary. But I also think, look, we have a Paul Schrader movie out right now, which, you know, is made certainly not made by a young guy,
right.
but it's one of, I think, the best movies he's made in many, many years. And we're in the midst of producing a number of extraordinary films by younger filmmakers, filmmakers of color. We're doing a lot of television. I just think it's a very exciting time to be creating content, and I don't look back. I am not nostalgic.
Okay, so let me be practical, because as I said, if I, as someone who's looking for the new voices in cinema, I knew that in the early 90s I would have to go to Sundance or to the Gay and Lesbian Film Festival. Nowadays I have to go on YouTube?
I don't know. You know, I think it depends what you're looking for.
Something that I haven't seen before. Something that's completely new.
I sometimes go on YouTube if somebody points me in the direction of something. More likely I look at, I see what comes out of various film festivals. I also watch a ton of content on other platforms. You know, we created a show for Sundance Now called This Close, which is, you know, on the face of it, it's a show about a young woman who lives in Los Angeles and her best friend who's a gay guy, but they're both deaf, and they created the show, and they wrote the show, and they star in the show, and it's really unlike anything you've ever seen before. And besides the obvious giving voice to a very underserved community, it's also wholly original and entertaining and interesting. So, you know, that's just the tip of the iceberg. I find that television these days, or whatever you want to call television, since most people don't watch it on television,
right.
We could say episodic or long form, is really where the risks are being taken and where okay. I find a lot of delight.
Such as?
Well, I mean, like This Close, like, okay. you know, the obvious shows like The Americans or Homeland or what have you. Okay. But I think you just have to dig deeper, you know, and you can find, you know, everything from High Maintenance, which started out as a web series before it found its home on HBO. Catastrophe, Smilf, just really original voices that are really being given free rein.
Okay. Let's go back to your creative collaboration with Todd Haynes. How does it work? It's like a marriage, I guess, with two people working for over 30
right.
years already. Do you have to wait around at the office until he has some sort of breakthrough and comes to you with a project, or do you pitch him material? How does it work between you?
You know, really both. I mean, and you know, bear in mind, Killer's made close to 100 movies, and 7 of them are Todd's. So we're pretty busy, whether he's busy or not.
Okay.
usually we have a discussion towards the end of each project about what he's interested in for the future. He is unusually right now working on more than one project at a time, which he's not the most comfortable doing, but it feels like he can balance a bit. He's working on a mini series. He's also working on a documentary about the Velvet Underground.
Oh.
So usually he'll come to us with like the beginning of an idea, and we'll figure out what kind of support that idea needs. For example, with the Dylan movie, with I'm Not There, he came to us with the beginning of the idea, and really what we needed to do was help secure the rights to the songs. And we spent then a considerable amount of time making contact with the Dylan estate and figuring out a solution that allowed him to have as much freedom as possible. On Carol, that came to us really, the script was written, Cate Blanchett was already attached, so then it was much more about providing the, you know, the production support, helping to find the rest of the cast, etc. So each film, you know, Wonderstruck came to our office, we read the script and brought it to Todd, like, you know, is this maybe something you might be interested in? I usually can tell at this point.
How can you tell? That's interesting. How can you tell content that you say, that Todd would like it?
I just know him, and I know that this will appeal to him or not. You know, he likes to create worlds, and he likes to do things. He likes to take something on that has at least one element that's new to him. So if I feel like something meets that criteria, you know, as I say to people, I can show it to him. I can't make him do anything.
Right. So what made him be interested in something like Wonderstruck, which is, you know, it's a young adult film. It's a younger film. The younger cast. I don't remember him directing such a young cast.
Has children in virtually every film he's ever done. There's always children in some, you know, including Poison, and I'm Not There, and Mildred Pierce. I mean, pretty much everything. There's a child. I think in Wonderstruck, it was an opportunity to delve a little deeper, but also to create the New York City of the 70s and New York City of the 20s, which I think was really exciting.
Which I guess wasn't a challenge for you as a producer to make a smaller film. I guess it's not a big budget, and yet you have to make, recreate New York of the 20s and New York of the 70s and the great panorama in the Queens, which I don't know how you shot that.
It exists.
Well, they let you.
Oh yeah, they let us shoot it. For them it was extraordinary publicity.
Okay.
But and I think I think somebody tripped over the Brooklyn Bridge, but that was the only.
Okay.
We fixed it.
Okay. That was for me the most intimidating part. Watching, I hope nobody steps on it.
Right. Yeah. So did we.
Crush it. Are there other creative collaborations you have over those years, apart from Todd Haynes, or people just come and go because?
Well, I think it's important. Just back to Todd, it's important to talk about the creative collaborations that exist within the films that we make, like his collaboration with Ed Lachman, his collaboration with Mark Friedberg, Sandy Powell,
Carter Burwell,
Julianne Moore. Just, you know, there is a fairly consistent group of artists that help make those movies as extraordinary as they are. His editor for the past few films has been Afonso Gonclaves, who's incredible as well. And then in terms of other collaborations, you know, we made two films with Todd Solondz many years ago, Happiness and then Storytelling.
Right.
And then Todd Solondz made a number of movies without us. And then we made Wiener Dog with him a couple years ago, which I think was one of his strongest movies in many years. So I think everyone sort of, you know, Mary Harron's another good example. We made I Shot Andy Warhol with her. And then years later, we made Betty Page. In between, she made American Psycho. She's, you know, she's another person that we really love working with when it's appropriate. So it doesn't feel like there's a, you know, it's not like people are kind of coming in and out. People sort of stay in our world. And when it feels right, we work on other movies with them.
Let me try and see if I remember New York in the late 90s when I was there. I think that one of the days I went to visit, I just wanted to visit the offices of Good Machine.
Mm-hmm.
You were on the same floor with them?
No.
Your offices?
No, Good Machine and Killer were never in the same geographical space.
Okay.
We did produce Happiness together.
Okay.
I think Good Machine at that time, they were... they were in the West 20s, but then they eventually moved down to the edge of Tribeca, like the end of Canal Street, which might have been where they were when we did Happiness. I can't quite remember.
Okay. But those were the times when, you know, Good Machine were later sold to Universal.
Right.
And Miramax were later sold to Disney.
Right.
You stayed independent.
Well, I mean, we had, you know, Good Machine... And I don't really want to speak for them, but they, at some point, they realized, you know, they were smart, and they realized that solely the production of independent films was incredibly labor intensive and not very profitable. So they started a foreign sales arm that became
right.
very profitable. There was another company in New York at that time too, called the Shooting Gallery. And the Shooting Gallery also came to a similar realization, but they decided to start a post-production facility. Killer never did that. Killer always stayed very focused on the development and production of feature films. And I think inevitably, when you do something else, when you start a foreign sales arm and or you start a post-production facility, you realize that they're so much more profitable than the physical production of feature films. So the production of feature films kind of starts to fall by the wayside. So I think for Good Machine, you know, they became a very strong foreign sales entity, which made them attractive to someplace like Universal.
Mm-hmm. But they were the... you know, the guys, you know, James Seamus and Ted Hope and Good Machine and the Weinsteins at Miramax. Did you ever feel that you were the girl among the guys, you know, nowadays? I've read Down and Dirty Pictures and
right.
the clashes between Harvey Weinstein and Todd Haynes way before Harvey Weinstein was dragged in handcuffs.
Right.
He was a monster. He was a bully. How can you create and you worked with him? I don't remember how many films, but Office Killer, you distributed
Office
through,
Killer,
through
Velvet
Mirror,
Goldmine, a couple other movies that probably didn't make it here, but also I'm Not There, Carol.
So, do you feel like you were the last girl standing? Everybody on the.
I don't know. You know, I don't think about it that much. You know, a lot of the people that you mentioned were my colleagues, and you know, Ted Hope and I continue to work pretty closely together in his new position as well. It's not so new anymore, but in his position running Amazon,
right.
And you know, and James and I, you know, while we haven't collaborated in a long time, we've got a very, you know, a kind of continual discourse about what he's doing and what I'm doing, etc. So I don't think it's that simple. I mean, the Weinstein stuff, look, I was on record from, I think, you know, in Peter's book, but, you know, of course, very publicly in my life about, you know, the difficulties of working with him and how, you know, I didn't like doing it. And it was, I always felt like, you know, I had to sort of stand between the movie and him, and it was unpleasant and miserable. But of course, that kind of bullying, absolutely unacceptable behavior, kind of obfuscated the other behavior, which he's on trial for, because right. He's not on trial yet, but presumably will be, because I think it was only a very small circle that really knew that that behavior was going on. And in some ways, it was like the loudness of the bullying sort of drowned that out in a crazy way.
What made, when I went back to the chapters about Harvey Weinstein in Peter Biskin's book, in retrospect, I said, okay, if he's treating someone like Todd Haynes like that, yelling and screaming and wanting to tear his film apart, obviously he's doing horrible things to other people
right.
who didn't come forward and speak to the
right.
book, because it wasn't a creative discourse,
right.
sort of. So in retrospect, one would have to think, okay, how could have been so blind and say, okay, that's Hollywood people for you, but but something more darker and sinister is going beneath the surface. So if I want to make an independent film, a really edgy film right now, and in the 90s I could go to, you know, the Shooting Gallery on Good Machine or Miramax or Fine Line, I think, or October was in the 80s or
no,
or
October,
90s.
October then
or
was
USA.
Acquired by Universal. It started as USA, right. Then it became October, then it was acquired by Universal as October, and that was the company that famously financed Happiness but then dumped it once they realized what it was about.
Okay. Where would I go now if I want to be starting
you? I don't know what, I mean, it's really, it depends what you're making. It depends how commercial your story is. It depends, you know, who are your actors? You know, have you already made a film that has had any kind of international success? And if the answer to all is basically no to all of those things, then maybe you're not making a theatrical feature film. Maybe okay. you're making something for the web. You know, maybe you're making something for your YouTube channel. You know, I think it's just, it's too hard, and I feel so unhelpful to take the 90s and try and smash what we're doing now into it. It's interesting to hold it up and say, how does this resonate with, how does our time resonate with that time? But to you know, that constant question of, like, could you make Happiness now? Could you make Boys Don't Cry now? It's like, well, would I even want to? You know, I'm older. The world is different. I'd make a different one. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd make a different version.
No, but on the other hand, it's the same questions that, like, when people nowadays say, oh, you know, Hollywood only make Transformer films and Marvel films, and in the 70s they made Midnight Cowboy
right.
and The Godfather. So people's nostalgia towards your time, toward the beginnings of your career, the things that you've made, I think it's a way of appreciation. Okay.
But we're still making great movies. I mean, that's the thing, is it's like, you know, in the past couple years, you know, we've made Still Alice, we've made Carol,
right.
we have Colette coming out, you know, with Keira Knightley. We made Lemon by Janixa Brava, which is an extraordinary movie. We made White Girl by Elizabeth Wood, Goat by Andrew Neil. These are all movies that I think are amazing. So I think part of what people are feeling nostalgic for is a time when there was a lot less content, so it was a lot easier for something to make noise and for you to decide, like, everybody wants to see that movie, everybody wants to see this one. And now, you know, it's the amount of content is so overwhelming, I think that, you know, it's very easy to miss a gem.
Right.
I think, you know, I can't fault content. I think content's as good as it's ever been.
Right. And you've rebranded your company as Killer
yes.
Content, not
yes.
Killer Films.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit about the Oscars, because when you read about your company, and of course, or Todd Haynes, the films that are mentioned first are those who were either nominated for an Oscar or
sure.
or won those. Is it important for in your business model for a film to be nominated or winning an Oscar?
You know, awards attention is always great. And it's certainly, you'd really need a distributor here to parse out exactly its effect on a film's financial health and life. I mean, my guess is that Boys Don't Cry winning that Oscar probably means that movie moved into the sort of pantheon of what we call evergreens, which means a movie that will never lose an audience. Mm-hmm. And every year when, you know, it's Oscar time and all these various platforms start, like, you know, doing, you know, the 10 best movies that ever won an Oscar, the 10, you know, et cetera, it gets to be part of that pantheon, and that's great.
Right.
So, yeah, on the other hand, I think we all are well aware of movies that were overlooked for whatever reason, and now you think, you know, that's just, you know, that's absurd. So for a small company like ours, Boys Don't Cry going to the Oscars was an enormous deal. And Hilary Swank thanking us on, you know, on the air, was, you know, that really did change our lives to a certain degree.
Oh.
But now, you know, look, we, you know, Still Alice was very critical because the whole gamble on that movie was, you know, Julianne not only being nominated but winning, so it worked. And, you know, I get asked a lot about Carol's lack of a Best Picture nomination, which, of course, at the time was very disappointing. But now I don't even know if anyone can remember what was nominated that
right.
year. I can't.
That's true. That's about the Oscars. But do you have a notion? Do you have an instinct to say, okay, that could go far? That could be, or
yeah,
do you leave it entirely to the distributor?
You do, but you know, there's always. I mean, the sort of fascinating thing about filmmaking is that, you know, it is that William Goldman quote, no one knows anything.
Right.
And the movie you expect to, like, hit it out of the park sometimes is dead on arrival. And the movie that you just think, like, I don't know about this one, just suddenly is, like, the bit, you know, First Reformed is doing incredibly well. And I'm thrilled, but I'm also, like, I didn't see that coming.
Okay.
You know, it's such a personal, intense film, and sometimes it's just like the luck of the draw. Sometimes it's a brilliant distributor who's like, you know what, I'm gonna open this movie, I see a hole, I see a time, which I think is part of the reason First Reformed is doing so well, besides the fact it's great. We wouldn't even be having this conversation if it wasn't great. But a lot of great movies don't make it. But First Reformed, the A24, who's an up-and-coming distributor in the U.S., who I think are really smart, they saw that there was this time period where there were just no movies for adults.
Right.
And so if you wanted to go see a movie, it was like Han Solo, you know, or whatever, The Incredibles or whatever. But if you just wanted to go see a film that you could chew on, that you could talk about, there just wasn't anything. So they kind of zipped the movie into that period, and it took off. So that's great. Sometimes, you know, you make a movie, and it's just not the right time for it. And for whatever reason, people just don't react the way you hoped they would. But the great thing now, of course, is that movies can live on and on and on and get rediscovered. Wonderstruck did not do well theatrically. And of course it was disappointing, but now the film has a whole new life on DVD, on streaming platforms. So I'm getting a whole new kind of interrogation of the movie and what it's about, and, you know, in different ways. That's really exciting.
Yeah, I have to tell you that my 16-year-old girl daughter really loved the film.
Good.
And yeah. And I would love to talk about more about First Reformed. The problem is that I haven't seen it.
No, that's
and,
okay.
And I don't know if it was picked up for distribution here in Israel. I'm quite certain it will be shown in Jerusalem, right? Jerusalem Film Festival. I'm because they're doing a good job there. So, but what made Paul Schrader come to you? Because he's worked with so many people, but
actually, I think it was Todd Solondz.
Okay.
I think Paul, you know, he had some bad experiences where the movie he was making got taken away from him or recut right. by his financiers. And I think, he and Todd Solondz are friends. And I think Todd said, you know, you should really just show it to Killer. You know, they somehow managed to get these movies made.
Okay. That's a good reputation to have. And you're here in Tel Aviv for the TLV Fest because yes. you produced the opening night film, My Days of Mercy.
Yes.
How did that entire package come? It was directed by an Israeli filmmaker, great filmmaker, Tali Shalom yep. Ezer, who made Princess. Here in Israel, people know her for her first feature film, Princess. It wasn't a huge hit, but I think that many people know about the mm-hmm. about the film. How did that come about?
I've known Ellen Page for many years. She was in a movie we made called American Crime, directed by Tommy O'Haver. And she was 17 or 18, I think, when she made that film with us. So a few years ago, she approached us with a script that she had been developing with her friend Kate Mara, and they wanted to do this together. Mm. We worked with them and, you know, helped develop the script a little further along, but the real question was, who was the right director for this? So we started exploring various people, and we're really trying to find someone who we felt could bring, a very personal twist to it, and could really kind of understand the intimacy. I liked the idea of it being somebody who wasn't American, just because I thought that would be a different point of view on a lot. I mean, there's a lot of aspects of the story that do feel very rooted in kind of American culture. We just looked at a lot of movies, and I can't remember. It may have been David Hinojosa in my office who said, you know, remember that movie that we saw at Sundance last year, because we had seen Princess at Sundance. He said, I think we should all look at it again. And we did, you know, so we showed it to Ellen and Kate, and they responded to it. And you know, it wasn't the first time that we made a English language movie with somebody who, for the first time with somebody. We've done that a couple of times. We did it with Sebastian Silva, mm-hmm. for example. And it has challenges, but it also, you know, there's obviously a lot of rewards. You know, I think the biggest culture shock on both sides is American movies really have to be made in an extremely efficient, streamlined way. And most European, and I'm lumping Israeli into European, even though technically it's not, but let's say for the sake of this discussion, so I can just use one adjective, European filmmakers, because their work is subsidized, they're often paid a lot more, for example. They have a lot more time to shoot. And they don't have the same concerns in terms of, like, what makes something commercial or not commercial. It's like a whole muscle of their brain they've never had to use before, you know? And it can be not every European filmmaker likes, you know, can handle that transition yeah. or wants to keep doing it after they've done it.
That would be the real Europe, I think, in Israel, because the budgets are so small that I'm not sure that Princess was shot in more than 20 or 25 days.
I think Tali had a lot of those same issues, though.
Okay.
I think it must have been, because when we told her the number of days that we wanted to shoot Princess in, shoot Mercy in, I think she fell on the floor. So
how many days were there?
Well, we ended up shooting it in 23 or 24 days, but I think the original schedule was 19 or 20.
Okay. So she said, I'm coming to America and I'm making an Israeli film.
No, No,
that's what why she fell on the floor. Maybe she thought she'd had 60
days. I think she just didn't understand. It's just the whole concept of how the American unions work, where there's a lot of rules. Like you have to have, I think a big thing for a lot of European filmmakers is, who are all these people? Like, why do I have to have all these people on my set? And it's because that's the way it works. So I think for a lot of those filmmakers, it's like, well, I could do it with less. I just want less. And it's just like, but that's not,
right.
It's not an option. So there's that. I think there's, you know, there's certain rules about, you know, I've always, you know, American directors, for example, American directors don't speak directly to the extra talent, to the background talent. The assistant directors do. And in fact, directors aren't really allowed to speak to the background talent. And that's just a thing that, you know, it's not just European directors have. It's any director that moves from making a tiny personal movie mm-hmm. to a bigger film has to sort of face the challenges, some good, some bad, some more difficult than others.
But ultimately, when I saw the film on Thursday, the thing that I loved about it, that I saw so many of Tali's yes. sensibilities in it, because, you know, it was, the way she frames the...
Yes.
She brought her DP from Poland.
That's right.
That she worked with. So it was a very American film, very American independent, you know, film, and yet I could sense that it was something that was done by a filmmaker who has her very own point
Absolutely.
Of view. And the interesting part, what you said about an Israeli or foreigner making film, that the intimacy took over the entire, you know, political mm-hmm. Backstory about death row and
right.
politics and everything. That becomes the backstory. That becomes the stage for making the story about the intimacy between those two characters. And she's really great in producing intimacy. And you know, something about people who are different, who are negatives, but also twins. I think mm-hmm. that the twins, you see it with the sisters in the,
sure.
in the film. And the, well, so yeah, so I really liked the way she handled the film. And what's next with this film? You were in Sundance with it, I think.
You know, I'm not, it was at Toronto. It is going to come out in the States in the next couple of months. Of course, I was, you know, Tali interrogated me last night about when it's going to open here, and I'm just not sure exactly. I probably should have checked before I came, but I'm not exactly sure what all the plans are in terms of its international rollout.
Right. Okay, that's just about it for me. Thank you very much for coming to my studio and to Israel, and I hope you recruit many Israel filmmakers to your future films, female, male, straight, gay, whatever films. I hope you have a chance and maybe produce a film here in Israel. This is a true independent state
All
of
right.
film, so you can come here. I'm sermonizing for the Israeli film film community. Thank you very much for being here, and one of my favorite Todd Haynes' films is Velvet Goldmine, so we'll finish with a song from that film. Thank you for being here, Christine Vachon from New York, and that's about it.
You've done it all. You've broken every code. Paul the rebel. You spoke the game, no matter what you say. But only metal, what a ball. Blue eyes, how can you tell?
There's nothing left, all gone and run away. Maybe you'll tarry for a while. It's just a test, a game for us to play. Win or lose, it's hard to smile.
Signal from another world.